Hey folks, welcome back to A Talk in the Woods. I'm Lily Horn. In this episode, I met up with Caitlin Bernard, who is the Natural Resources Policy Advisor with the Maine Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. I first met Caitlin when I was a high school Nordic skier and she was coaching the Maine U16 team. During this conversation, Caitlin and I walked on trails at Pineland Farms, talking about skiing, Arista County, college, and the funding of the Land for Maine's Future program. It was fun to have this opportunity to catch up and experience Pineland outside of a ski season. Thanks, Caitlin.
So my name's Caitlin Bernard. I grew up in Fort Kent, way at the very tippy top of Maine. I have always loved being outside and ended up, you know, I was a very passionate cross-country skier when I was a kid and wanted to ski in college, so I ended up at Colby, also in central Maine. And I've been inching my way south since then. After graduation, I started working at the Appalachian Mountain Club. That was my first job out of college. It was really awesome. I got my feet wet in policy and events and sort of the main outdoor recreation space on the work front. And then just a couple years ago, I made the transition over to work for the Nature Conservancy in Maine.
And so I met you as a ski coach and you're helping out with U16s and Eastern high schools and all of that. And
yeah.
So now you're coaching the Falmouth team.
Yeah. I've coached the Falmouth team for, 6 or 7 years. I started out with the middle school program there, which was really silly and fun and pretty cool to be able to work with a kid from, you know, sixth grade all the way up to their senior year. That's been a really interesting transition to watch some of these kids grow and change. And so it's been really fun. Yeah, I think Nordic skiing is absolutely a passion of mine and something I hope I'll be involved in for my whole life.
Yeah, it is a lifelong sport,
yeah.
Which is one of the best things about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Can you describe Arista County, or the county, as it's often called,
Yeah. And
what it was like to grow up there?
Yeah. Well, it's huge. It's the biggest county east of the Mississippi. It's really far away from everything, so it's got this funny little community. I grew up in Fort Kent, which is in the St. John Valley, so it's got this French heritage in sort of baked into the town. My parents are not from Fort Kent, so everyone in town was related except for my family. We were Canadian, so we came over. My parents came over before I was born. And, it's a really funny place. It was really awesome to grow up there. There is not a lot of, typical, you're 3 hours from a mall. The movie theater would get, a movie 6 weeks after it debuted in theaters and other places. So that kind of, pop culture-y stuff that people have growing up in more urban places was not really there for us. So we spent a lot of time outside, not with any sort of really serious outdoorsiness, but just that was the only thing to do. We would go camping. We would go for walks. We'd spend some time, out and about. My dad's a forester, so he knew the landscape up there. He works for a big landowner, big forestry company. And so he always had little places that he had seen on his work trips, and he would bring us there as a family. We had just the basic, Walmart tent or the equivalent, and, it was always a really fun, always fun to be outside. So I feel, very lucky that I had that, and I guess I didn't really realize that not everybody grows up with that in their backyard, with trails and rivers and lakes and, places to go.
So how old were you when you started skiing?
So we probably started skiing. I have a little sister. She's 2 years younger than me. And we probably started skiing when we were in elementary school. It was definitely the classic, we didn't love it. So it was M&Ms and candy and treats to try to get us to go along the trail. I remember getting my first pair of cross-country skis from L.L. Bean. And my mom was really nervous. She ordered it in the catalog. And she was nervous that my little sister would be jealous. But she played with the box. It was obviously a big box. She played with the box for years, and I used the skis a few times and didn't like it very much. So I think she got more use out of the box than I did out of those skis. But in middle school and then into high school, I certainly spent a lot more time skiing. We were so lucky to have the 10th Mountain Biathlon Center in our town. So that developed, they had a World Cup there probably when I was in middle school. And so we got to watch some of the best skiers, and it was definitely inspiring. And so once I got to high school, I joined the Nordic team and didn't really know what to expect and had a lot of fun. It was a really great group of people. And from there, I really kind of buckled down and got really into ski racing, which was really fun.
Yeah, and I'm sure you were telling me on the walk over here, too, getting to travel so much and getting into biathlon, which not everyone is familiar with biathlon. So yeah. Do you want to describe what biathlon is?
Sure. It's cross-country skiing and then shooting at a target. So it's a very unique sport. It's extremely popular in Europe. It's like their football. They have primetime biathlon races, and the biathlon athletes in Europe are, you know, celebrities. But here in the U.S., it's really small. It's pretty targeted at certain pockets where they have the facilities to do it. So, you know, Lake Placid, New York, where they had the Olympics, they have a biathlon club sort of program there. Northern Maine, Utah, because they also had the Olympics there. Northern California. There's just little pockets of it where people do it. It's because it's so small in the U.S., I had a really enormous opportunity to travel. And the athletes who were training for the Olympics at the time when I was in middle school and high school, it was the same thing. The only places they could go to train for biathlon were Northern Maine or Lake Placid or Vermont. And so we had a lot of exposure to Olympians or people trying to make the Olympic team who would come and live in Fort Kent and train. The coaches were, top notch. The national team coaches were living in Fort Kent, and athletes would come to them. So my sort of youth programs were run by Olympic hopefuls and Olympic athletes, and pretty amazing. And lots of women, which was really cool to see, have female coaches, and I was super lucky. I mean, it's a really amazing and unique opportunity to be basically the little league equivalent of biathlon with an Olympic level coach in Fort Kent, Maine. Pretty nuts. My little sister always said, you know, in rural Maine, across Maine even, I mean, soccer and basketball, they're the very popular high school sports that everybody knows about and is excited about. And my little sister used to sort of say with like a cheeky sarcasm, you can send me a postcard from the Bangor, you know, basketball tournament, whatever, state championship. I'll send you a postcard from Europe, because that's where skiing can take you. That's like, it goes so far beyond Maine, and you have the opportunity to travel to a lot of different places. So I just thought that was pretty funny and cheeky
that
of her.
Very funny. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so growing up in Arista County and spending so much time outdoors, how did that influence your choice to go to Colby and your career trajectory since then?
Sure. Yeah. I guess when I was in high school, I didn't necessarily know I wanted to stay in Maine. I was excited to go check other stuff out. I had been able to do a fair bit of traveling, which was really awesome. And yeah, I sort of circled around. I really wanted to keep cross-country skiing. I looked at schools in Vermont and Maine and New Hampshire. I looked at a few in Canada, just trying to figure out where I wanted to be, and Colby just felt like the right fit. And oddly enough, it's one of the closest schools I could have chosen to Fort Kent. It's still 4 hours. And so to me, it felt like a whole new world. It was really different from Fort Kent and where I'd grown up, and it was far enough away that it felt like I really went away, but definitely I was still close by and went there with a lot of people that I knew from high school, from different ski teams and ski programs, which was really fun. I think I didn't really know what, I mean, like most, I think, 18-year-olds, I didn't really know what I was doing or what I wanted to do. I got to Colby, and I think, you know, they sent out the over the summer register for classes, and I'm pretty sure I set up like the classic high school schedule, like English, science, math, French or something. I don't know. I had like just the standard, like, here's what you have to take. That's what you do in school. And I remember going in, you know, my parents dropped me off. They were nervous, trying to figure out what this was all going to be like. And I went to the bookstore to buy my books for my classes I had chosen. And I was wandering around and found a section of books that I just wanted to read for fun that I was like picking up and like, oh, maybe I should pick this up. Maybe I should try this. And I kind of had this moment where I was like, what class is this for? This looks fun. Maybe I should take this class instead of reading this on my own. So yeah. I remember kind of like, you know, being my first day alone and calling my mom and saying, Mom, I think I'm going to switch all my classes. I think I'm going to start over. And she, I'm sure, was kind of freaking out like, oh boy, is this a good idea? And it ended up being great. I ended up taking a course called, it was a cluster course. It was called the Green Cluster. And it was three classes with all the same students. And it was environmental activism, I think an environmental philosophy, and one that was sort of more science-y, like probably just like an environmental studies 101 kind of class. And that was probably the best decision I'd ever made. I got to know this group of three. I mean, as a freshman going into a totally new place,
I had three classes with all the same people. And so we got to know each other really well. We all, for the most part, ended up being environmental studies majors. So we all got to work together and know each other over the years and do our thesis together. And so it was really awesome to find that community right away. And I definitely didn't know going into it I wanted to do policy or anything environmental, but it was really fun. It was something that I was really interested in, and I feel super lucky that I took that leap, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And all just because you were finding books in the bookstore.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. I know that for some people working in environmental policy, it seems like it can go both ways, where some people who feel a really strong connection to the outdoors, working in environmental policy is just their calling and they love it. And then for other people, they find it very frustrating working on the political side. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's definitely ups and downs in politics, but I really like it. I've always loved people. I've always loved getting to know people and understanding different perspectives and getting to understand how people got to be where they are. And so I've always really liked politics. It feels like a game. You've got to figure out what motivates people, what they're interested in, what's driving their passion or what issues they care about. And, you know, I think environmental, especially, I certainly started out heavy in the land conservation, right? So it's a very bipartisan, it's like a apple pie, you know, kind of issue. People really love their communities. People really love, especially if you live in Maine, whether it's hiking or skiing or ATVing or hunting, people have an appreciation for what's around them. And so it's pretty easy to convince people, whether or not they like to do the same things I like to do, that there's a important reason to be protecting places and to be sort of keeping Maine the way it is and showing off that we have these amazing assets. And it's definitely a unique state. I mean, you think about the range of small land trusts and parks in a place like this, like Pineland, that's pretty developed, and then lots of other places, state parks are beautiful and amazing, and they still feel rustic and far away. So there's endless options here to find what suits you. So it's definitely been an issue that's been easier than some to bring people along in the policy sphere. And yeah, I enjoy it. I like getting to know people. I like trying to figure out what kind of messages resonate with them. And yeah, it's been really fun.
Oh, good. That's so good to hear. I think you're right. I think people can really get behind conservation because they can see trails and places that they're familiar with and things that they can use, and it's a very tangible sort of thing.
Right.
So on the walk over here, you were telling me about the Land for Maine's Future program, which is a huge deal. So you want to describe that project?
Sure, sure. So it's something I've been working on since I started in this environmental policy world. The Land for Maine's Future program is a source of conservation funding for projects all over the state. It typically is funded by a bond, so voters vote for the bond anytime it's on the ballot. It's had huge support. I think every time it's been to the ballot, it's had far above 60% of support from the state, which is great for a bond measure. The last bond was passed 8 or 9 years ago, so we've been working on finding additional funding for the program since then. We've had a tough sort of circumstance of politics. Not that it wasn't a popular issue, but there was always some sort of fumble at the finish line where we would get, you know, the issue pretty far along and then the pandemic happened and that changed everything, or we would get close to the end and, you know, the program had funding, so it was pretty easy to kind of set it aside for a little while for policymakers and say, hey, we got to focus on this other stuff. So we've been really trying to keep it at a slow boil for many years, making sure politicians understood what the program was, what it did, showing off all of the hundreds of places around the state. And it funds a whole variety of things. It funds, you know, large sort of forested classic recreation areas. It funds boat launches in communities. It funds working waterfronts even. So places along the coast are obviously hot for development. And so you can use the Land for Maine's Future program to purchase a coastal waterfront area that fishermen and the public can access, which is a really cool thing. And then a new-ish flavor, too, is working farmland. So the Maine Farmland Trust is an organization that focuses on that really heavily. So they help farmers find money to keep their farm as a farm and not have it turn into a subdivision. So we've been working on it for a really long time. It's something that people really like. I think the challenge is getting people to understand the sort of the structures behind these places. So, even, you know, my partner's an engineer. He doesn't work in environmental conservation at all. And he still is like, what's the difference between a land trust and a state park? Like, there's certainly a messaging issue where there's so many ways that these kinds of projects can be conserved that we have to figure out how to message them so that people understand, like, oh, this one is owned by a local land trust and they have a local board and local staff and that's a community resource and it probably was funded with state and federal support. But also your neighbor might have contributed funding to help protect this place. A place like Pineland is totally private, so they are able to manage this with private money from all of the various things that go on here. State parks are a whole different beast. They've got state funding, then national parks. Like, there's so many ways that you can protect a place. And I think we're trying to start to explain to people all of the different options that are out there and all of the different resources. But the Land for Maine's Future win is really exciting. We just got it. Governor Mills included it in her supplemental budget. So that's really exciting. We've got $40 million for the next 4 years. And it's a really exciting opportunity. I hope that land trusts and land conservation groups all over the state are starting to think about what they could do. I mean, that's a huge pot of money. So it's been really exciting.
Wow. Congratulations. Yeah. And thank you for doing that work.
Thanks. Yeah. And I guess I'll mention, you know, on the federal side, I do both state and federal policy. So there's the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is the federal match often for the Land for Maine's Future program. So at the federal level, within the last 2 years, during the pandemic, which is crazy, or, you know, over that course of the last year, that program predates the Land for Maine's Future program, and it's a surcharge on offshore oil and gas leasing. So it's not our tax dollars going towards it. It's the oil companies are developing the ocean resource for oil and gas, and the ocean belongs to everyone. It doesn't belong to anyone. So they pay the United States a fee to develop offshore oil and gas. So that money gets collected and used in the same way as Land for Maine's Future to protect places all over the country. And so I think Senator Collins often talks about 97% of counties in the U.S. have funding from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. It's everywhere. It's not just pocketed in certain places. And so here in Maine, it can be, you know, small parks and recreation places, you know, tennis courts, swimming pools, like the towns can access it for support for baseball fields, that kind of thing. And then it's also supported these enormous projects like Grafton Notch State Park up in the Bethel area has gotten LWCF funding. Big pieces of Acadia have been supported with Land and Water Conservation Fund funds. So also in the last couple years, it feels like crazy to have all of this sort of culminate at once, but we had that program. We got permanent reauthorization, which means every single year this program is available. Congress doesn't have to set a time limit or set it, you know, 5 years, it'll expire, that kind of thing. We got permanent reauthorization, and we got dedicated funding at $900 million a year for the U.S. to have access to conservation funding. And so it was allocated at $900 million when it was first created in the 60s, and the program sort of went through the congressional budget cycle, which is far too complicated to get into in the podcast, but they had been sort of allocating different levels of money based on how the government was running and who was in charge and yada yada. And so now we have it. Originally, it was intended for $900 million a year. We've got it set at $900 million a year. So starting now, the state of Maine has access to a huge amount of federal money and a huge amount of state money, and organizations can pair those together and come up with some really exciting projects, which is exciting because it's dovetailing with, as I think everyone has heard or seen or even anecdotally experienced, so many people are trying to move to Maine right now, and the development pressure is crazy. So it gives a lot of new tools and resources for groups to say, this is a really important asset to our community or our region. Let's find the resources to buy it and protect it. And it helps everyone. It helps everyone's property values stay high, or it's an asset to the community that brings people here. So it's exciting. It's really, I'm hopeful that Maine in the next 4, 5, 10 years will really use this as a catalyst, and it's exciting to think about all the new and exciting places that could be protected for people to use.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting to me too is that the development pressure is really high, but also the pressure on all of these local trail systems and how many people are getting out and using them because of COVID, that's also become way higher.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. And I'm hoping, I think all of us who work in this space are hoping, the outdoors is certainly having a moment, like you said, and there's so many benefits. There's health benefits, there's stress reduction benefits, there's just this community connection, there's all kinds of benefits of these places and increased use on these places. And so there's upticks in volunteers and events and all these different things. And we're all hoping that it sticks. We're all hoping that people who went out and bought a mountain bike or a boat or got really into hiking or backpacking, that they keep going with it because it can only be good for them. And success breeds more success, right? If we have more volunteers and more exciting places to go and people really passionate about them, we can keep growing that realm, keep growing, you know, the amount of places that are available. And I think it comes back to messaging on those of us who work in this field. We've got to talk about all of the hidden gems that people don't know about, right? We've got to think about what are the trails that are getting overused? What are the places that are sort of at capacity? And then how do we promote these other places that could stand to have a little more people and a little more attention? And so that's definitely a challenge for us to be thinking about and understanding the capacities of different places. But so far in Maine, you know, I think there's room for everyone. I think there's still plenty of places. And, you know, it's, you know, I was trying to think about where we could go today, and this one is just like so big and open and easy, but there are certainly many other places, and that's kind of cool. You know, this one is very accessible to everyone here at Pineland. It's got this huge parking lot. You could probably push a stroller on these ski trails, but there's the public reserve land. There's Libby Hill, which is managed by the town in Gray. There's all kinds of trails all around. The land trusts here are doing great work. And so I think there's room for everyone. And I hope that we can keep this excitement around the outdoors, and it certainly drives a passion for people to protect the environment. And so that certainly does for me anyway, getting out here sort of refuels why I like to do the work that I do every day.
Yikes, it's buggy here. Yeah. Do you want to keep moving?
Yeah.
Before I forget, could you describe where we are and what this place is?
Yeah, so we're at Pineland Farms in New Gloucester, Gray, New Gloucester. It's this kind of a silly place. It's got like an industrial park, but it's also got these amazing trails. It's got a frisbee golf course. It's kind of got a lot of different things. And it's definitely the central hub for Southern Maine skiing. All the teams come here to train and practice in the winter. It's definitely a place I've spent a lot of time coaching and being around and skiing. And luckily, it's only 7 minutes from my house, so it's one of my local trails. And I've spent a lot of time here over the last year because I could meet up with friends and coworkers and people and be outside and still have connection. Even when we were socially distant, you can walk 6 feet apart on these ski trails. So it's definitely been a place that I've been very grateful to have close by.
Oh yeah, me too. It's funny you say that, because this is very, you know, you can walk in Bradbury, but those trails are much more narrow, and these trails are made for social distancing.
Yeah, exactly.
They're nice and wide.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we were looking at buying our first home, my partner and I were toying with all kinds of different parts of Maine and wanted to be close. He works in South Portland and I work in Brunswick, so we were kind of circling around where could be sort of in the middle, and Gray was not necessarily on our list, but we found a really cool house and we checked it out, and then we thought, hey, we're close to the mountains in Western Maine, we're close to Portland, there's trails everywhere, and once we moved in and settled, we realized that there's even more than the obvious Pineland trails. There's a Pineland Public Reserve that the state manages, there's Bradbury, there's all kinds of stuff, local land trusts around, so it's been a fun place to be. Yeah, we have kind of endless opportunities here, and we're close to a lot of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. This is a great spot. I also wanted to ask you about Maine Teens to Trails and your work with young skiers and connecting young people to the outdoors.
I feel super lucky that I was able to have access to all of these places as a kid, and it's interesting to go, you know, grow up and go out in the world and meet different people and understand that not everyone had that access or that opportunity or, you know, even awareness that that was something that they could do. Teens to Trails, they started, they've probably been around for 15 years or more. I've been involved 8 years, maybe, at least. They have been doing really great work. They're passionate about connecting. Their focus right now is on high school kids, and they focus on outing clubs at high schools because, like a sports team or a civil rights club, like, schools have this infrastructure where kids can get access to things that they might not know about or see about, or their parents might not be interested in at home. And so I think the big focus on the outing clubs was to think about a non-competitive way for kids to be outside and to spend time together and to explore the state of Maine. I know even growing up where I did in Aroostook County, there were friends of mine who had never been to Acadia, who had never been to the ocean, who had never been on the Allegash River, you know, different things that, like, even when you're right there, if you're not connected to it or your family isn't equipped or interested in it, you might not ever have that experience. So a big part of this outing club focus is that it could get kids where they are. They're at school. Their friends are kind of interested in this stuff, and it gives you an avenue to go explore those things. So it's been really fun working with that organization. They've certainly grown and evolved over the time that I've been working with them. The founders, Bob and Carol Leone, have retired, and so it's taking on a different angle, and it's just cool to have had the perspective of seeing the organization under them and how it's changing. And I hope I haven't connected with them in a little while, but I hope that they're excited about where it's going. I think it's definitely an inspiring mission and an inspiring organization, and pretty cool that they were able to spark that.
That's very cool. Often the push is on organized sports and competitive sports. Having something different.
Yeah, and I know, you know, my best friend in high school started an outing club in Fort Kent when we were in high school, and the group hiked Katahdin, which was pretty amazing. Not a lot of our class, I had done it and she had done it, and, you know, a handful of our friends had done it, but I think for a lot of people on that trip, that was the first time they'd ever done anything like that. And so, really cool. You know, it was inspiring to see that, and definitely a big part of why I got excited and involved with Teens to Trails is, like, seeing even my friends who had not had that experience before take on something that they never would have otherwise. And actually, a friend of mine who did that trip, and that was his first time hiking Katahdin, just hiked it again a couple weeks ago. So it's kind of funny to think about how it sparks something in people and they can continue doing it for the rest of their life.
Yeah, that is so important. I think the experiences, talking to people, the experiences that you have as a young person in any realm, but I think in the outdoors especially, it just really shapes your relationship to the outdoors as you move forward.
Yeah. And I hope a big part of sort of my philosophy, gosh, if you could even call it that, but I love working with kids because I think it's an opportunity to show them, like, it doesn't take much to try something new, and certainly skiing, there's a lot of gear involved, and I work really hard to try to make sure that that's not a barrier for people. So helping them understand sort of what they need to get started, how to get, you know, how to sort of piece together gear from used places, or we have a huge net. I mean, skiing, the Nordic ski world is this network of people who all love skiing. And so trying to find them different people who have aged out or who are selling their skis and try to make sure that people have access to that. Because I think sometimes people feel like the barrier to entry for some of this stuff is so high and so hard that they can't even get started. And I really try to, like, create or, like, help friends or, you know, making it feel like it's no big deal. It's easy. You know, I love going out with friends who are learning how to ski and trying to make them feel like they can do it. It's not this intense Olympic. You don't ever have to be at that caliber. You can just go out and have fun. And it doesn't have to be a marathon. It doesn't have to be intense. It's just, you know, we have all of this here. You live in Maine. Let's go out and do something fun. Let's snowshoe. Let's, you know, get to see what's out here. And certainly places like Pineland and Quarry Road in Waterville, there's rentals available. Certainly, I love downhill skiing too, but cross-country skiing is certainly a little bit more affordable on the rentals and the day pass side. So it's a cool opportunity for people to get connected to the outdoors in Maine in winter.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've always had a policy, at least in my experience coaching, that any new skier was always welcome. And we tried to give them as much attention as possible, you know, balancing the experienced skiers who were training for states and New England's and all of the competitiveness, like trying to balance that. And I think, you know, I had a handful of kids over the course of my coaching who tried Nordic skiing as a senior for the first time ever, which they were some of the coolest kids. Like, it's hard to try something new, especially when you're in high school. something that you've never done, something that you're not necessarily going to be good at right off the bat. And it's always really cool to watch somebody sort of take a leap, try something new. And they've been really fun to work with. They just seem like, even if they never do it again, even if they never make it to like an actual race or they come last in a race, it's been a really cool perspective to see people really trying new things. And I always like really enjoy working with those athletes. It's really fun to help them sort of see like, this is something new that you can try. If it's not your thing, you still have like the courage in you to try something else that's new. And that's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we had two Spanish exchange students, actually, who tried Nordic skiing. One actually was living with our family, Katine.
Nice.
And she was amazing. She just was, just like you said, just jumped into everything.
Yeah.
Just very open to trying new things. And she wound up loving it. And she had so much fun. And she really misses it because, you know, she can't do that in Spain. And it was so impressive. A, just the cold. That was the first year our team went up to Fort Kent for our, like, winter training trip, and it was so cold that year. That would have been the December of, I think, 2017.
Yep.
And it was freezing.
Is that the year where it was like 20 below every
day? And her eyelashes froze, and she was like, this is so cool.
They're so memorable, those kinds of trips. And you know, kids come back and of course they exaggerated a little too to their friends, like, oh, we went to Fort Kent and it was 100 degrees below zero.
And Fort Kent, it's like 7 hours away.
Exactly.
Like,
it's
basically Canada.
That was such a, I was really nervous. That was one of my earlier years coaching, and I was afraid somebody would get hurt. I mean, right, it's cold, it's dangerous, like, you don't want anybody to get frostbite or get lost. And the kids were kind of playing in on that. I mean, cross-country skiing is hard, so Some kids were like, oh, I'd rather just like hang out with my friends in the cabin. So they were like, oh, coach, it's so cold. We really can't practice today. It's so cold. And I kind of was like, nope, we're doing it. We're going out there. We're going to practice. Right. And so we get back to the cabin that night, and half of the team is outside building this enormous snow fort outside of the cabin. And I was like, if it's not too cold for you to build a snow fort, like, we're practicing. You're not fooling me. Yeah. I get it. You just wanted to come back and build a jump, which is fun.
Yeah.
But we're going to ski.
Thanks for listening to A Talk in the Woods. For more conversations about Maine's land, water, and people, check out other episodes available wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast is a product of the Maine Mountain Collaborative, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about our mission, visit mainemountaincollaborative.org.